On the Sky News Centre at 6, the Prime Minister says Britain stands ready to help those affected by the devastating floods in Pakistan. The Pakistani government's relief agency claims 12 million people have been affected by the heavy rains. David Cameron's been speaking after talks with President Zardari at Chequers. He tried to smooth relations after his comments in which he accused Pakistan of exporting terror.
The President and I have been talking about what we see as an unbreakable relationship between Britain and Pakistan based on our mutual interests.
The gunman who took part in the UK's biggest jewellery robbery has been jailed for 23 years. The man Kassai planned and executed the raid at Graff Diamonds in London's Mayfair last summer. £40 million worth of gems were stolen. Three other men were each sentenced to 16 years in prison. Former Flying Squad detective Barry Phillips says the investigation is far from over.
They brought in those on the day to commit the robbery, but there'll be a draftsman, the old-fashioned individual who puts a job together. He'll be involved with the upper echelons of a criminal network, and they'll be the people that the Flying Squad will now be focusing on.
A youth consultant who admitted trying to groom a girl he thought was 13 online for sex has been jailed for 21 months. 56-year-old Simon Beard was caught by undercover journalists after arranging to meet the girl in West London in April. Nottinghamshire police have started an internal investigation after a 14-year-old girl was accidentally shot with a taser gun. Officers were aiming for a 20-year-old man as they tried to arrest him in Nottingham on Wednesday. The force has apologised. In sport, England's cricketers are in total control of the second test with Pakistan. They were 112 for two in their first innings when bad light stopped play after bowling the tourists out for just 72. In football, the Championship season kicks off in the next few hours as Norwich hosts Watford. And in showbiz, Robbie Williams is to marry his American girlfriend tomorrow. According to The Sun, the singer will tie the knot with Ida Field on a romantic island off California. That's the latest. I'm Rachel Jewell.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Ramazan Assalam, Ramazan Assalam.
सुनना मत भूलिएगा PCFM का अपना रेडियो रमदान 2010 जो हम आप लोगों के लिए लेकर आ रहे हैं 9 अगस्त से लेकर 12 सितंबर तक इस पाक महीने में सुनिए कुरान मजीद की तिलावत मुख्तलिफ नाते और नशीद पांच वक्त की अजान और माह रमजान की मुख्तलिफ खूबसूरत और रूहानी प्रोग्राम से इल्म हासिल करें सिर्फ PCFM रेडियो रमदान 93.2 FM पर
Welcome back to Friday Drive Time with old Labour economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Former BBC South and West Request Show host Helen Reid joins us in a minute to talk about bullying in the workplace. How do you know if you're being bullied? And if you are, what can you do? But first, there's been fears this week over a fatal dissident bomb in Northern Ireland after members of the public narrowly escaped injury when a car bomb exploded outside a police station in Londonderry at 3:20 a.m. on Tuesday. A taxi driver had been hijacked in the city and forced to drive his car to the station after a device containing 200 pounds of homemade explosive was loaded on board. A telephone bomb warning from the dissident Real IRA group then came in. Now, this week, Drive Time reporter Richard Cowley, who served in Northern Ireland in the Parachute Regiment, looks at the history and scope of the Northern Ireland parades, because right now it is, of course, parade season.
King William of Orange was a Dutch Protestant who attacked the Catholic King James II at the Battle of the Boyne, which occurred in 1690. And that is commemorated by, therefore, the Orange Institution in Northern Ireland today. A transition that began with a change of power from the Catholic Stuarts to the parliamentary system of rule through the House of Hanover.
So the House of Hanover was a Protestant house?
Yeah, it was associated directly with the Protestant King Billy, as he is more locally known.
So what's the point of parading around the streets of Belfast?
Parades are cultural now in Northern Ireland. The majority of parades are held ostensibly by Protestants, Unionists and Loyalist groups. Parading is actually considered by the people of Northern Ireland, including Nationalists, to be an assertion of a group's control over a particular area or territory. And as a result, parading can be highly controversial at times. Out of approximately 2,800 parades that occur every year, at least three quarters, if not more, of those parades are Loyalists and Unionists. Only a handful, about 140 or so, are actually nationalist parades.
And then what about the Parades Commission? Because this was established to look very closely at parades and their effect on the political process.
Yeah, Parades Commission was eventually set up, and it exists to settle specific disputes that occur due to the controversy within parades, although not all parading groups actually recognise the Commission's authority, and in specific, the Unionists and Loyalists.
So are parades a frequent issue, and how often do they occur in Northern Ireland?
They are very frequent. I have a list, actually. For example, on the 17th of March every year, there's a St. Patrick's Day march. Then on the 25th of March, the Ancient Order of Hibernians, religious Lady Day and Easter parades are again by the Nationalists. The Sunday Republicans political parades that commemorate Easter risings that happened in 1916. And on the 5th of May, there's Republican political groups again that commemorate the Republican hunger strikes of 1981. Those are all Nationalist marches. Whereas on the 1st of July, the Orange Order march in context to the Mini 12th. And on the 1st of July, again, various groups, mostly Unionists, for example, the Battle of the Somme, is commemorated in the anniversary of the first Sunday. But recently we've seen the 12th of July, where the Orange Order have marched what they call the 12th, which celebrates the Williamite victory, the Battle of the Boyne in 1690, and also the Battle of Ochrim in 1691. Then on another important date is the 9th of August, where Republicans commemorate the introduction of internment of 1971. So there seems to be a lot of, you might say, insignificant reasons to demonstrate the either the victory or the memory of something. Still rather kind of a Boy Scout thing, as far as I can see.
The Orange Order organises the Loyalist marches. Is there an equivalent group within the Republican Nationalist movement?
Sinn Féin are orchestrating pretty much every march that occurs of any value to the Nationalists.
What are the types of parades then, and names of all the organisations that organise parades?
We could talk about the Loyalist bands, which belong to Unionists. There's 483 marches per year, 33 of which are very sensitive ones. Orange Order Unionists themselves march 452 times a year, and 23 of those are classified as very sensitive. The Apprentice Boys of Derry, which is the most famous one, are their parades 230 times a year, more or less. Royal Black and Royal Arch Purple Unionists march 167 times per year.
Sorry, well, I've never heard of the Royal Black and the Royal Arch Purple Unionists. What are they?
Well, I've never heard of them. I can only imagine that they're another splinter group or, you know, a satellite sort of attachment to the bigger known Loyalist Unionist groups, the Orange Order. Or then there's church parades, including boys, brigades, girl guides, legions of Mary, etc. These are not necessarily aligned to any political group, which march 157 times a year. Then the major military groups that march include British Legion. They're not necessarily aligned 149 times a year. So we could go on. This list is pretty extensive, but we could, for example, say the Hibernians and Foresters, that's a nationalist group, they march 28 times a year. Nationalist bands of the IRA types, 59 times a year. And other Unionist groups, party politically associated, 21 times a year. And in total, the total amount of Unionists or Loyalists that march is 1,354 times per year. But the total Nationalists in comparison is only 144 times per year.
That's the Nationalists really only marching about a tenth of the number of times that the Unionists. Now, the big controversial thing about these marches, Richard, is when they go into areas which are not actually Unionist areas or they're not actually Nationalist areas. Can you tell me why these marches are allowed, you know, well, one side of the divide to actually march triumphantly through some victory parade the other side? Because that sounds to me like the problem here is that it's okay if you march in your own town, in your own area, but why do these marches have to go through other areas?
The Loyalist, I would get the impression, and I think it's true to say, are more provocative in their inclinations by the choice of routes that they can easily avoid. It's fairly well known in Northern Ireland that the Loyalists utilise their opportunity to march because of the lack of authority that prevents them from doing so, to simply exploit the potential provocative result that they get from doing so. They know that they control the law. They know that the nationalists have very little say in it, despite recently becoming members of the Northern Ireland Assembly since 1998. The peace process that was initiated at that date is consistently stressed by the lack of control, so that, therefore, loyalists in Northern Ireland have to recognise that if they want the peace process to be successful, they need to significantly stop marching, not only in areas that are obviously nationalist, but limit the amount of marches. So, as you can see, there's 3,000 odd a year.
Should parading now be more limited, as it's a provocative opportunity for trouble?
The loyalist legacy, basically, is a tradition of parades that continues today. It's an unnecessary thing of the past. And the peace process is, as I just said, now under stress from these outdated concepts. Parading is basically a controversial issue in Northern Ireland, and many parades are seen as sectarian or otherwise offensive. In general, the roots of the parades are questionable. People from one community often object to parades by the other, passing through or near their Catholic areas or nationalist areas. So, for example, the Orange Order parades march through mainly nationalist or republican areas. A few parades are seen as objectionable in any case, regardless of their route, mainly because, well, these involve the paramilitary groups, such as the IRA or the Ulster Freedom Fighters. And also, there are non-conventional parades, classified officially, that nevertheless are causing conflict because they carry banners and flags which are associated with paramilitary groups. We could even mention Gay Pride as being a group that is, in fact, controversial in some areas of Northern Ireland. Looking into the history of this, I can only assume that the rumour, of course, is true that King William of Orange was, in fact, a homosexual. Many people who are IRA, well, nationalist Catholics, are naturally, by tradition, objectionable to concepts of that type, so they're naturally religiously against it.
So would you say then that the unionist side actually support these Gay Pride marches?
In my opinion, for what it's worth, I think they do, because British legislation encourages it since 1967.
Now, that was Drive Time reporter and former soldier who served in Northern Ireland in the 1980s, Richard Cowley, there, with his report on the rights and wrongs of the Northern Ireland marching tradition. And we'll be hearing Richard's conclusions next week. Well, with the introduction of structural mass unemployment and changes in union laws here in early 1980s Britain, the balance has tipped firmly in favour of the employer and against the employee. It used to be that if you got the sack, you could pretty much walk straight into another job that suited you, and therefore relations between bosses and workers had to be good. Employment was a contract, and there was a sense of mutual respect in most workplaces. Well, BBC South and West Request Show presenter Helen Reid is just one person who felt bullied when she was at work, and she worked for a non-profit corporation, the BBC. Well, hi Helen, and welcome
hello.
To Drive Time.
Hello Tony, good to be here.
Now, what was your job at the BBC?
Oh, I had a wonderful job. I obviously presented a request show on a Sunday afternoon. I also reported across many of the other programmes throughout the day, Monday to Friday, Saturday, and I took the radio car out early in the morning, which was absolutely the best, from 6 till 9. Hard to imagine getting up early, but it was great.
And so what sort of things were you covering, and how long did you actually work there?
Oh, I worked there for 8 years, and initially just training, and then I was sort of fortunately talent spotted one day by the old BBC manager, who said, "Who's that woman?" And I think I was just holding a mic for someone at the time and had to take over in an emergency, as they say. The sort of things I did were mainly feature pieces, some news pieces, but mainly humorous feature pieces or real personality pieces, because I know it sounds daft, but that's actually, you know, what can be a bit thin on the ground. I mean, we can get lots of people reading scripts and actually, you know, well, being very intellectual and being very clever.
Well, but we try and do that on here.
Yes, you try and succeed. But I think some of the things that they actually wanted across the programming at that time was a really sort of interactive, humorous and people-based feature type feel to things. So I was actually asked to input a feature in most hours throughout the morning programme. So, yeah, that was my brief.
And what were you doing on the Sunday show?
Oh, the Sunday show was a request show, which was it was just great, you know, because you'd talk to everyone and anyone. They'd phone in with requests from sort of wartime to, you know, the current day to, you know, feature sort of stuff that fascinated people to wonderful stories of love and romance. So it was great.
And so was that going out here in Bristol, in Somerset, or was it going further?
The request show was going out in Bristol and the South West, so Bristol and Somerset. And some of the evening shows, for instance, I'd cover for Trevor Fry or whatever, would go out really across the South West, down into Cornwall and across into Wales.
So what happened?
Oh, well, I had a fantastic career. I absolutely loved my work, overjoyed with my work. And then the management changed, and which isn't unusual. Management changes within any organisation. And, of course, managers are perfectly within their rights to change their staff. But I suppose it really depends upon how management go about changing their staff, really. And I just experienced a very difficult period over 2 years, or nearly more than 2 years, of someone actually, I later found out, sort of practicing sort of workplace bullying on me. And I think other people had had a similar experience too in the past.
Now, is it particularly difficult when you're working on things either as a freelancer or on these rolling contracts? Because it's like when you come up to your contract being renewed, it's like you don't really have any sense of permanency. And that, to me, I think is a real problem, because it means that you're working in the constant fear that, oh gosh, you know, is that going to be the axe next time my contract's up to be renewed?
No, absolutely. I mean, I don't want to, you know, make a big song and dance about this now. I mean, this is, you know, many years ago now, and difficult things happen. And, of course, management change. Unfortunately, some of them leave, which is great for the organisation. But I think at the time, what doesn't help in the media is that it's very competitive. We all want to do it. We love our work. Unfortunately, some people do sell a little bit too much of their soul to keep their work, and maybe won't speak up when something difficult's going on. I mean, not most individuals are pretty fair. But and I think also, as you say, the short-term contracts mean that you are in a terrible position of insecurity. And even if you have a full-time contract, I think the whole issue of competition in the media and the fact that it's joyfully, you know, expansive, interesting work, it may not be the best paid, but it's certainly interesting work, means that people do not want to rock the boat. So very difficult, I think, for people to really speak up against something difficult that's going on, unless it's very overt. And if it's happening to you, of course, you've got no option unless you leave, and you know, unless you actually disappear into a sort of cloud of ill health, which many people do. But I think very difficult in the situation when you do experience bullying in the workplace to actually get people to stand up for you, to club together for you, without fear of losing their jobs, of course.
Now, let's have a song. Why did you choose this song?
Oh, I had to choose this one for my own request show, obviously, because I used to play this when things were getting tough, particularly towards the end of my contract, when I thought things were really going to get bad and I was almost out the door, and people would phone in and say, you know, we've got to hang on to you. I used to play Gloria Gaynor, I Will Survive, because, you know, just to keep us all going there.
That stupid lock.
Now that's Gloria Gaynor, I think 1979, if my memory serves me correct. And I'm joined by Helen Reed. Now, Helen, can you just give us an idea? How would I work out if I'm being bullied or if I'm not? How do you know?
Yeah, we were just chatting about this, obviously, while the music was on, although I was trying to listen to that great piece of music. But we've got several people in the studio here, and we're all talking about what is bullying. I mean, it's not necessarily being sacked unfairly, and it's not necessarily being given a hard time or having your contract ended. What it really is, and those people who experience it do know, that it's actually a persistent, constant undermining, sidelining, drip, drip, drip effect, which completely, almost completely destroys, you know, your capabilities to work and express yourselves and actually do your work properly. I mean, it really does take the form of constant nitpicking, fault finding, criticism, and often of a trivial nature. Constant refusal to acknowledge you and your contributions, attempts to undermine your position, status, worth, things like daft things, I mean, and horrendous things, really, like if you're a broadcast journalist, which I was at the time, having your telephone taken away from you, having your laptop taken away from you, not having a desk, you know, not having anywhere to work, all sorts of things. But, you know, you know it if it's happening to you. And I think what people must do, I mean, that's just the tip of the iceberg. What people must do is they must take they're feeling seriously. If they really, it's not just a sort of vague intuition, you really start to feel ill. I mean, I think it takes months before you realise, you just think, well, this is a difficult personality thing. And we all have run-ins with our characters we work with, or we have personality difficulties with people. But I think this is something else completely.
So is it just, do you think, your boss that might be bullying you, or is it other people who are maybe even someone who you're supposed to be their boss that could possibly be bullying
you?
Well,
it is technically possible to be bullied either up or down. I mean, we do know that there are cases, you know, because we've done lots of research for years now, that, you know, people can certainly bully their managers. It's rarer, though, of course, because you're not in a position of power. It's usually someone in a management level who's bullying someone at a lower level, who's actually more precarious and more vulnerable. And I don't think this happens all the time, and I certainly don't think this happens. I hope it doesn't happen very much in the BBC anymore, because they took great steps, I think, to improve how things were, obviously, with all the sort of research that's gone on and union help. But I think at times there are characters who somehow get into a position of management. You know, someone like Tim Field, who was the world bullying expert, who unfortunately died of cancer, like many of the experts in bullying. It's very bad for your health, bullying, you see.
Actually trying to write about it help people who are being bullied?
Yeah.
Can very be bad for your health.
Very bad. I think if you've been bullied and it's an area that you've been working in for a very long time, of course it's very stressful and very bad for your health. Yeah, and many, I'm digressing slightly, but three of the experts who initially, Andrew Adams, a colleague of hers, and Tim Field, all died of cancer. But I digress anyway. I think what they and many others have actually come across is the fact that there are some people drawn to management in all sorts of different areas, not just broadcasting, but obviously broadcasting is very competitive, so it's a difficult, precarious situation to be in. But many people are drawn to management who may have power problems, and some of them may even be verging on the sociopathic in terms of character problems. And I think it's very difficult to spot this, and actually very difficult for very senior managers to then deal with it, because once you're in a big organisation, you know, the management structure tends to support itself. And as we know, HR, their brief many years ago, and hopefully it's slightly better now, is just to support management rather than really, you know, make sure that something very fair is going on. And as we know, because we know each other through the union, Tony, and then Bristol Union, NUJ and everything else, very difficult, no matter how well-meaning the union, even though some of them aren't very effective, very difficult for them to actually make a huge difference, because colleagues and other people who are afraid to speak up, and even some of the people who are doing the bullying, may be union members.
Well, I mean, when I was secretary of the branch, I did have several cases of people coming to me asking me what to do about certain, and also whether it was bullying that they were actually experiencing.
Yes.
Now, one, oh, I won't name, person was saying that they were actually getting anti-Semitic comments made about them by their boss at work.
Yeah.
And another, and then when that didn't make them back off or leave, then they were actually moved from the production office down to a basement office on their own next to the boiler room with a telephone
normal
that had
behavior.
Actually keys on the telephone didn't work properly.
Yeah. This is a perfect example. I know it sounds petty, but if you string this together with dozens of other examples, like, you know, being sidelined, not being involved in meetings, like you say, being put in the basement, not being acknowledged, being ignored, not having a parking space. Being shouted at, I don't think is really a problem. So if we go on to the PM story, of course, that happened earlier in the year, I think just the odd shouting at because of stress isn't necessarily bullying. But when you put those things together with lots of other factors and things that have been going on for months and months and months, if not years, with a character, what you get is a perfectly sound, intelligent person turning into a blithering idiot over, you know, a period of time.
Can you tell us about that story then that you mentioned from earlier in the year?
Ah, you mean the PM story? I mean, we all heard about it. It was back in sort of February, March. And it was a story about our ex-Prime Minister supposedly being a bully because he'd shouted at some people in 10 Downing Street. Now, why this story happened was because the BBC did report it, and they reported it because the woman called Christine Pratt, who runs the National Bullying Helpline, actually completely unconfidentially leaked this story to the press. I don't know whether it was to advertise her organisation, but obviously the BBC reported it without necessarily checking their facts to make sure the organisation was a charity, etc. And it meant our PM got sort of another slating amongst the millions of others he'd received in the previous years for being a bully, which we don't necessarily think is the case.
So what was the problem, though? It's not just
about raising your voice.
I mean, what's the problem, though? Because surely it's important that issues like this are raised in the public domain. Mm. You know, what do you think she was actually breaching confidentiality then?
Definitely. I mean, if it's supposed to be a confidential helpline, none of it should actually be breached at all. Of course it shouldn't.
Now, what about the law? How does the law stand on all this? And in things like employment tribunals, that kind of thing, if you feel that you've been bullied at work and actually pushed out illegally, is there anything that you can do about it?
There are things technically that you can do. I mean, obviously, we've got to say, first of all, the advice we do give people who are in experience of having a workplace bullying or thinking they are, is that you must document and diarise all the events that are relating to your bullying case. Everything, no matter how little, because the little things actually add up and they're terribly important. You must actually really get as much help as possible, talk to your union, talk to your colleagues, and obviously if you can get help, fantastic. If you can't get help, then you have to go it alone. And this might mean eventually, after, you know, having this sort of terrible frustration of your family and everyone else upset, this might mean that you have to go the legal route, which could be either through the union or it could be independently.
Now, can I just backtrack you slightly? Yes. There? Because before you start actually writing events down,
yes,
quotes down from said to you,
you
at certain times,
yes,
how can you actually be sure that there is something here, that it is bullying and it is worthwhile to do it?
I think you don't think it's bullying for a very long time. So therefore, months and months may go by without you even realising, Tony, you know. So I think what happens is the penny drops at some point. I mean, when it happened to me, we're talking, first of all, nearly a decade ago. So things were very different then. And I think there's more awareness now. And there was very little to read then. So it took a very long time before the penny really dropped. And then it was reading Tim Field's bully site, which was, you know, a complete breakthrough. But now there's much more information around. And I think people are more aware. So if you start to feel ill, if you start to have sleepless nights, if you start to feel stressed out for no reason, if you start to feel completely isolated at work and all those things which weren't normal a year ago or 6 months ago or 2 years ago, you know, it may come to you that you're being bullied. And if that comes to you, take yourself seriously. And what we must also point out is that we know from masses of research, and I was talking to David Hinton, an academic, earlier actually on the phone to get some recent information. He was saying that a lot of the North European countries now have done some fantastic research. You know how efficient they are, saying that we think that people are bullied because maybe they're not very good, or they're a bit shy, or they're a bit awkward, or somehow they're weird. I mean, that could be my case. I mean, you can see me. I could be weird and like you are, Tony. But we realise now, we've realised over the past few years, that usually people are bullied because they're very good at what they do, because they're
really
exceptionally good at what they do. Yes, and it could even be the case, obviously, with school, you know, school bullying. People may be unusual, they may be mavericks, but they usually have a touch of something, which means they're either very efficient, you know, very popular, and this usually happens because a line manager of sorts, someone who feels probably very insecure in their own way, very inadequate in their own way, actually doesn't like and feels that there's something to compete with and something to undermine here or something to be got rid of.
But I mean, the normal perception is that if a manager or somebody is bullying you as an employee, that actually all they're trying to do is to get you to do what they want you to do and to sort of fit in.
Well, I think there are people who are very inefficient and probably deserve to have their contracts ended, quite rightly. I mean, no manager has to put up with someone who's not very good at what they do, you know, unreliable, whatever else. But if you look at, you know, we haven't got time now, but if we look at the bullying cases, you know, Laurie Mayer, who was over in the southeast of England, an exceptionally brilliant broadcaster who was who actually stood up for other people in the workplace who were being bullied what is it when you speak out for other people?
Mentoring.
He was brilliant at what he did, absolutely brilliant. And so, I think it's about changing people's perception of.
So he was someone who was actually trying to stand up against bullying in the workplace, and
Laurie
was himself sacked.
He was then himself sacked. Yeah, he went to an unfair dismissal case, and unfortunately, the tribunal, which we're coming on to now, found that there wasn't enough evidence to actually confirm his case. But
so that's probably why that people can often feel very isolated when they are being bullied, because all of those around them in the workplace are thinking, well, hang on a minute, I better not say anything or it'll be me next.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Or your contract may be ended or you may never work again. I mean, I think we should do a very interesting piece, Tony, about what happens after you've been bullied. Where are all these people? Probably in the other side of the planet doing something, different programs, different careers, all sorts of things. But talking to David Hinton today, who's an academic who's researched at some length for many years into bullying in the workplace, he was saying that and sadly, after years and years of research, they're still finding that tribunals, which aren't actually proper courts, although I didn't realise that until recently, still don't do a good enough job to actually help people who are being bullied and to help people in those aspects of employment law.
So these are employment tribunals where when you've been sacked, you can then go to the employment tribunal and at least take your employer, your previous employer, to task, maybe to get compensation or something?
Yes, sometimes you can if you're lucky. It's very difficult to prove a case because it's very difficult to get people to stand up as witnesses, as we've mentioned. Usually if you do win, I won a case which was, you know, I don't know why we even bothered really, because I think it made us iller than actually going obviously before the case. But we got some compensation, but really it only paid our legal expenses. But I think what's important is you can't just necessarily walk away from a situation where it's blatantly unjust and other people will be bullied once you leave. I mean, it's perfectly within your rights to walk away and obviously start again somewhere else. But if you feel there's a bully in a situation and they have to be removed or something has to be done, then someone has to put their head above the parapet, even if you're going to get shot and never work again. You know, so it has to be done. So I think that's why sometimes you have to go to the tribunal. There's nothing really in it for you, but it's a matter of justice. And what would happen if we all stood by and did nothing?
Now, was there any pressure on you to sign gagging clauses and things like that? Because I know that's another thing which can happen, that you're supposed to sign a little thing that says, I will not speak about this publicly.
Absolutely. Well, I think
that actually can compound things. Yeah. Can it make it even worse, feel like you're being even more bullied?
Yeah, I think that's horrific, really. What happens, I think, if you go through the union route, and most of us have to because we can't pay privately for union for legal representation, is that the union have a legal representative or legal sort of company who do represent them, and the unions pay a set rate per year for this cover. Now, we only discovered this, Tony, or all of us discovered this some years ago, that the NUJ were paying a certain amount of money to their solicitors, Thompsons, which meant it would cover all their legal advice and all their legal cases. Now, of course, that's a very small amount of money when you've got different people who need to go to tribunal, and of course, barristers are expensive. So it may mean, and we can't say, obviously, you know, we can't say, we don't have the facts as such, but it may mean that the legal companies are less willing to go to court because it's a very expensive process. So therefore, they're more likely to encourage the union to put pressure on their members to say, yes, we can get a small amount of compensation compensation. It may just be a few thousand pounds. And it is nonsense, the figures we hear in the paper, by the way. You only ever get a few thousand pounds if you're lucky. But in order to get that few thousand pounds, you always have to sign a gagging clause. Now, you know, to ask anyone to sign a gagging clause who has been, you know, unjustly bullied, abused for months, if not usually years, I mean, I think that can actually make someone feel more ill than, you know, than actually the result of having of no positive result. And also it means that nothing can be spoken about. So effectively it means everything is buried in the sand and other people can go on being bullied afterwards. So, and particularly to ask someone who's a broadcaster or a journalist to sign a gagging clause is really the, you know, the complete lack of freedom of speech. I mean, what do we have if we don't have our freedom of speech?
Now, I'm also joined, as ever, by Martin Summers here. Now, Martin, you had an experience with being dismissed within the last couple of years in a rather strange situation where you were in the middle of what you thought was actually a project meeting when suddenly one of your managers kind of started talking to you about whether you were actually going to be able to continue your employment. Is there anything that you can do in these sorts of situations where you think you're being invited along for one type of meeting and then suddenly it turns into something completely different?
Well, I mean, I was still in my probationary period when that took place, and I did take legal advice, and I went to the union, and I also went to an advice centre, and what they told me was that I'd been treated very badly, but that I had no comeback because I was still in my probationary period. It was very bad practice to, if somebody's going to be disciplined or you've got some kind of disciplinary procedure, they must really be told about that before they go into the meeting. I went into a meeting which I thought was going to be a planning meeting about my work to find that I was actually being effectively dismissed in the meeting, or various allegations were being made and so on, and I'd not been given any warning that this was going to take place. Now, that's not bullying and persistence.
Yes, we were talking about that earlier.
This is just, you know, it's bad treatment.
It's definitely unfair.
Yes. I mean, everybody I spoke to said, yeah, it's very unfair, it's completely irregular. But because you're within your probationary, yeah, period, you've got no comeback.
But we were talking about this earlier and saying, well, of course unfairness happens, and of course managers and companies do want to sack employees. That's why they have the short period before, so they find out whether that personalities work or whether people are efficient or whether they're too efficient, in Martin's case probably. Then of course they are within their rights to get rid of you, but the bullying we're talking about is actually persistent, drip, 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 undermining, sidelining. It's really personal, yes, psychological torture.
I'd like to have had the chance to be bullied. I never got round to it.
Yeah.
But of course, the effect of something like that is it's actually going to rile you, isn't it? Because you're there prepared for one thing, and there's people are sort of shoving really undermining your entire security as part of your job.
It's very, very
the likelihood is that you're going to react very badly to that, and you actually may then be shooting yourself in the foot.
Yes.
Well, I mean, to be honest, I came in the next day and I was in a pretty bad mood, and I actually took various people aside and had words with them, and they didn't like it. I mean, I'd realised I was on the way out, so I didn't really care what I said by this stage. But
it's
also
a wonderful liberation at that
point. It is,
point,
but I also, yeah, in my final letter to my employers, I also pointed out that any reaction by me to this series of events was their responsibility, because they should, if they wanted to discipline me, have given me a warning that this was going to happen, yeah, and I should have been allowed to have somebody in there with me and what have you. They didn't pursue any of that. It was what I thought was a straightforward run-of-the-mill meeting turned into a kangaroo court. Mm. And I think that that's just totally unacceptable. And my behaviour, at the point that what I wrote in the letter, I said, you are responsible for me losing my temper, because you shouldn't do that. That's why you don't have ambush meetings. That's why, if you look in any management textbook, they will tell you, do not do this. You don't spring stuff like this on people without warning, because they're likely to react.
I think what's difficult too is that because you're going to react, I mean, if you're a normal person, you react in some way, and you're, you know, if you want to speak out, it's difficult for you to then get a good reference, because you can perfectly leave an employment situation and still get a good reference whether they want to keep you or not because you've acted.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, I mean, it's water under the bridge, but I mean, obviously, one of the real problems we've got as we move into a recession, depression, or whatever, the power of employers over employees is strengthened. Mm. People are scared. They don't want to lose their jobs. I didn't want to lose my job. I've not worked since. It's been quite difficult. I've tried to get work. You know, and people are genuinely terrified. And of course, the whip hand is with the employers.
And particularly when we love our work, if it's work that we feel, I mean, not all work is just a grind, of course. Some of it is delightful and exciting, and particularly media work.
I felt that this particular job, that I'd actually got on top of it, and I was actually feeling, the reason I was so surprised, because I thought I was doing really well. And I'd actually, in the 3 months that I was in the role, I think I'd actually managed to achieve what I thought was quite a lot.
You may have been doing too well, you never know.
Well, I think the problem is that people just don't understand. They didn't understand what I was doing. It wasn't a normal role for the organisation, so I was in a new role, which had not previously been done. And of course, I then had to make it up. You know, in a sense, you're a pioneer. You're creating a role that didn't really exist before. But of course, one of the problems is that the organisation then doesn't understand what you're doing, because they've never done it before. And that, of course, I would argue that I knew what I was doing, but they didn't understand it. And that's all there is. That's the way I would look at it.
Now, Helen, maybe you could just give us a bit of insight. Do you think that it's a different kind of workplace where bullying might happen? Or if bullying does happen, does that affect the efficiency of the organisation as a whole and the team, kind of teamwork? Mm.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, there are lots of different workplaces, and no workplace is completely cut and dried. I mean, there's always going to be some challenge. There's always going to be some demand made by management, and that's what we respond to. We love being challenged. And no one's going to have an easy manager. We don't necessarily expect to have an easy manager, but there are just some workplaces, and they are rare, thank goodness, where you do get that, you know, tricky character or very difficult, dangerous character turns out to be a bully. And I think what this does is it completely undermines the truly creative atmosphere of a workplace, you know, where it's very supportive, where staff can really grow and develop and be truly effective. I mean, we know from Tim Field's sort of, obviously before he died, all his research that we're talking tens and tens and tens of millions of pounds are lost, obviously, in illness because of bullying, and also a lack of effectiveness because of bullying and fear. I mean, if you're creating a culture of fear in a creative organisation, you know, where people are, you know, afraid to be themselves just because they may be bullied or afraid to actually support others, then, you know, it can't be a good thing for anyone. And I hope, and I think to in many extents, the BBC has actually got to grips with this and is, as creative an organisation as they can be. I know that Greg Dyke at the time, 2003-2004, was going to put his 5,000 of his top managers on a special training course so that they actually got to know all the different sort of avenues of workplace behaviour, and which was great, very creative. So I think the BBC, you know, has lots of challenges now, and hopefully is really appreciating its very creative staff.
You know, one of the problems is, of course, that as we go into a recession, there is more pressure to possibly to sack employees. And I know that one of the this is one of these sort of business school type things. Is one of the things that they look at in these business schools is, look, there are laws there about who we can sack and who we can't. We don't actually want to have to obey those laws. If we can actually get somebody to leave, that means that we don't have to go through all the legal procedures. Do you think that we may see an increase in this kind of thing? I know you're saying things are getting better at the BBC, but with a recession, that there are actually managers out there who are learning how to make people want to leave their jobs rather than actually go through the proper legal procedures.
Yes, I think there are going to be lots of strategies to obviously try and cut costs. And managers are under enormous pressure. Senior managers, middle managers, too many managers, as we know, are under enormous pressure to actually make their ends meet.
So I wonder sometimes whether it would be nice to just sort of allow the employees to stay and just get rid of all the managers.
Well, no, there is, you know, the NHS, you know, the media, all sorts of, the unions themselves. We all know there are too many managers, so maybe some of those could go and the employees get on and do the job, you know.
Now, we're joined by Marina Morris. Marina, you've got a little report for us now. What have you got for us?
Hello, yes. I will talk about deficit and longevity. The civil service is in the process of preparing whole government accounts for the year to 31st of March 2010, which are due to be published in the spring of 2011. While this might seem to many people just boring accounts you talk, the concepts involved are revolutionary. The government is adopting for the first time principle encapsulated within international financial reporting standards. Instead of accounting on a cash basis, where the taxpayers of today are paying today's bills, these accounts for the first time will seek to quantify the legacy of future costs which have already been incurred. What this means is that the government will have no recognize and presumably do something about this cost. Its opinion of the size of the public sector debts might well change. Major capital schemes have been funded by the private finance initiative, which makes schemes that can be paid for affordable by effectively renting what is in the past would have been public assets. But perhaps more important even that these are the pension rights built up by today's more than 500,000 civil servants. The government is facing an enormous crisis in funding this contractual obligation, which are growing as the people are living longer. But this increase in longevity also has a social dimension, creating issues for us all. Talking only about longevity without considering the quality of health and life is an old, devalued concept. What is the point of having a long life if we are suffering from debilitating illnesses, have depression, or even exist only as a functioning body, with those aspects of ourselves that represent our personality long gone? It can involve terrible suffering for us if we are sufficiently aware, be expensive and painful for our family and society. I would like to mention a legend of a cemetery of Asian village where the years inscribed on a tombstone date from a person's birth to a date which adds to the years of birth the number of years lived in happiness. The life which is celebrated is years of happiness, the rest is discounted. It is a definite advantage to create a role model to achieve not only long longevity, but to create a lifestyle, the longevity, this quality of life to be healthy and happy, they both are valued. These are two sides of one coin and two dimensions of achieving a happy and long life.
Thanks, Marina. Now, Helen, what Marina's bringing up there is this whole thing of longevity, which is actually even creating more difficulties in some ways for employers and for people in the workplace, because of course it means that there's pressure for people to stay longer in their jobs. And I wonder if there's a sort of demographic time bomb here, isn't there?
There certainly is. I mean, obviously, you and I, Tony, I don't know whether you're probably younger than me. I hate to say it. It doesn't look it, but I hate to say he's got a beard, of course. But I know that I'm not getting my pension till I'm 67. I mean, any pension. Mm-hmm. So therefore, I know I've got to work till I'm 67 and be. And in fact, I always thought I'd have to work to 77, at least working in the media, because it's not that well paid. But I think there is certainly a huge difficulty coming, actually, thinking, is there going to be enough work for everyone? Are we all going to have to work part-time? Maybe we're all going to have to actually accept that there are, you know, a smaller income, you know, lower standard of living, and maybe it will mean, if we can get the workplace to work for us and obviously make sure we downgrade bullying and everything else, if we do create creative workplaces and effective workplace for everyone, that we work less, I suppose, and we have a better quality of life, but don't have as much money. I don't know what
Martin. Yeah, I want to bring Martin in here because this is a potential explosive issue for the future, isn't it, Martin? When we're looking at the actual number of people that need jobs is actually increasing and increasing. Where actually it looks like potential employers, if the banks aren't lending and this kind of thing, that we're seeing the potential market for jobs actually shrinking at the same time. It's like a kind of tension on people.
We're in the biggest economic crisis in a generation, and my own view is that this is likely to be more traumatic than the 1930s because there's so much more at stake. It's an international crisis immediately. Everybody is drawn in. And when people talk about we can't afford to pay pensions to people, you've got to remember that civil servants, for example, have signed contracts which include the pension. This is a contract. Yes, this is. And do you see the bankers saying, "Well, we've got to have our bonuses because that's a contract between us and the bank, even though the bank's making a loss." But civil servants, they can rip up the contract that you signed. And people may have worked for 30 or 40 years on the understanding that they were going to get a pension. And then they turn around and say, you're not going to have it, or you're not going to have what you thought you were going to get. And the public PCS union has taken the government to court, the previous government to court over this, and the courts ruled in their favour, that these are contracts which have been signed, and you can't just rip them up. And they're going to have some problems legally with that.
But great having a union is prepared to do that, because not all the unions are. I know lots of people who worked in the building trade who actually paid in for many years, 30 years to 100,000, 150,000, got a payoff of 9,000 in the last few years and a pension that was 10% of what they should be getting. And of course, the shareholders still got, you know, their investment.
That's right. I mean, what's happened in the former Soviet Union, of course, is people ended up not getting their pensions paid. And as we go into a crisis like this, it's quite possible that people won't get their pensions paid.
Yeah.
We've got a serious crisis. We've discussed it every week on this programme, as we do.
Well, we like to mention it once a week, at least.
Just to make you feel better.
This whole idea that we can't afford this and we can't afford that. In actual fact, productivity per worker goes up pretty automatically 3% a year on average. So in actual fact, we are far wealthier than we were before. But the structure of our economy simply doesn't allow the kind of things we were talking about, like reduced working hours and better quality of life and so on. Because basically, I mean, I hate to say this, folks, but the financial system, the capitalist system, is kaput. It's finished. Yeah. There will be no more private banking. The private banks in the next 2 years will collapse again, and we won't be able to rescue them because we've spent all the money that we were possibly going to rescue them with, and we will have a major, major crisis, as in the 1930s. And the only way out will be public investment and the creation of a new welfare state where, for example, we might pay everybody a citizen's income. Rather than unemployment benefits, you pay everybody a citizen's income, which is based on the idea of a social dividend. Because the economy is growing, there is more stuff, and you've got to redistribute it to the bottom, otherwise capitalism doesn't work. And this is the big delusion of the free market era, because the more unequal society becomes, the more inefficient capitalism becomes. Capitalism is only efficient on the basis of redistribution, so that people at the bottom have got money to spend.
And
they've got money to spend, it doesn't work.
And for the civil income, it sounds like a great idea. We all contribute. We all actually work in the community and help.
And also, it would flexibilise the labour market
TV
as well.
Sure.
It would flexibilise the labour market, so you would get your citizen's income, which would be, if you're unemployed completely, that would be your unemployment benefit. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you can work 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours. The real problem at the moment, I'm unemployed at the moment, but the problem is I've got to get a 40-hour week job on X amount of money, otherwise I can't come off benefits. And that's just a disincentive. It's crazy.
Okay, now we must get back to bullying again, because Helen, one thing we haven't covered is what do you do? What do you actually do? Once you're really sure there's something going on in your workplace, or possibly even maybe for school children too.
Oh, school children, it's huge, obviously. We haven't even touched upon that. It's massive, you know, the amount of bullying that happens in schools. But of course, bullying doesn't just happen in schools. It happens in old age people's homes. It happens at home, in families. I mean, it happens in care. It happens in the armed forces, it happens in local authorities, it happens with neighbours and landlords. I don't mean everyone and everywhere, we're not being paranoid about this, but you know, there are situations where people are treated very, very, very badly, and this goes well beyond the realms of offhand behaviour, where people are made very ill by that continual bullying.
So what's the first move then? What's the best thing to do?
The first move to do, as we've said, once you've realised, must take yourself seriously. You know, get help from friends, get help from your family, talk to them, express yourself. Go to the doctor, talk. I don't mean you should go and get yourself an antidepressants, but just talk so people know what's happening to you, because stress has a huge effect. It will be affecting your sleep, your health in all sorts of ways. The fact that, you know, how you concentrate, you know, your behaviour, you know, in all sorts of ways that you wouldn't have known. It will be affecting your family and your extended family, and also, you know, the workplace for you.
So
it's very difficult for you to actually work as normal.
So are pills actually doing something about it, or is that just kind of trying to deal with it in another way and not actually dealing with it properly?
No, pills, I mean, you can take pills if you want to. There's nothing wrong with having antidepressants if they help you, but they're never going to be a long-term solving.
It's a sort of stopgap, maybe.
It's maybe a stopgap, as is some counselling, as is some support. And you must contact your union if you're in a union. You must also ask for help from the HR at the workplace. You must ask for help from other managers. You must ask for help from work colleagues. Take yourself seriously. Keep notes. Make a record of everything that's happening to you. And if you have a union, get involved with union and make sure you do get the help and advice you need.
Now, you can actually do, for many people, they can actually institute a formal grievance procedure,
they can.
Can't they?
Virtually all workplaces now, if they're reasonably large workplaces, have grievance procedures, and you must talk to HR about this or talk to other managers about this. There is a grievance procedure. There is a strategy for this, and it should give you some support. Ultimately, it may not give you the support you need, but there is a helpline you can ring. ACAS have a helpline. There are very few helplines around because they're very difficult to fund. They're very expensive. But the helpline number, and they will talk to you about different strategies. The number is 08457 474747, and we'll say that towards the end of the programme again, 08457 474747. Look up on the internet for, you know, workplace bullying or school bullying, whatever's happening to you. Look up on the internet, and there are lots of different organisations offering help, and please take their advice. You know, lots of it very hard won and very hard written about, Tony, isn't it? We actually set up a strategy within the NUJ to actually a bully survival guide. So it took us many years to do it, but we did do it, and it's also helped huge organisations actually change their strategies and change the atmosphere.
Now, the other thing I can remember is keeping a diary. All this thing about even what about taking photographs and things like that?
If it's appropriate, yes.
I mean, most people now have got a video camera or whatever on their mobile phone. If someone's actually bullying you,
definitely
might that actually make things worse though, if you're trying to film a situation where you think you're being bullied?
Well, I think it's probably very difficult to film and record a situation where you're being a bully because it won't be authentic. But if you do get the chance to record something, then do. But obviously you can't take it to extremes, and you can't actually record someone without them knowing. As we know, it's illegal, and use that against them. So you've got to be sensible, get advice, and actually do what you can. But the most important thing is to take yourself seriously.
Okay, and could you just give us the website of the Tim Field website as well? Because I know that you found that immensely helpful.
Oh, fantastic. Tim Field, of course, now deceased, but his family are carrying on the work, and he's a hero for our times. www.bullyonline.org. And lots of other organisations too, so please look up, you know, bullying in the workplace on the internet. That number again, 08457 474747. And you know, bless you, wish you well if you're having that terrible experience, and it does change your life.
Okay, we're going to finish now with a little bit of music, and this is the right sort of thing, I think, for bullying, which is Joe Cocker with A Little Help From My Friends.
Absolutely.
Sang out of tune, would you stand up and walk out on me? Lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song. I will try not to sing out of key. Yeah. Oh baby, how do
Joe Cocker there. Well, that's all for this week. Coming up next to Sky News at 7, and after that, Friday night is Music Night with BCFM's Mash Up to the Weekend. You'll be in the expert hands of DJ Spungold. Do please join us at 5 on Friday Drive Time each week here on BCFM 93.2. If you have a story for us, questions about this evening's programme, or want to suggest a guest for a future show, go to www.thisweek.org.uk or email me at tony@bcfm.org.uk. That bully helpline number again at ACAS is 08457 47 47 47. I'm Tony Gosling. Thanks to all our guests, Helen Reid, Richard Cowley, for the Northern Ireland Orange March. We'll have the second part of that next week. Marina Morris and old Labour economist Martin Summers, as well as Guy Kingston, the Bristol branch of the Federation for Small Businesses. See you next week.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.